Well, I'm Andrew Hailstrap, and I'm National Chair of Christians in Science, and it really is delightful to see you all here. It's a wonderful crowd, and we're particularly delighted to welcome Martin and Margot Hodgson for tonight's lecture. And the numbers that are here suggest that quite a few of you have come across them, so we're really delighted. Martin Hodgson is a plant scientist and environmental biologist, but he's also operations director for the John Ray Initiative, which some of you, I'm sure, have come across. That's an organisation connecting the environment, science and Christianity. But he's also a visiting researcher at Oxford Brookes University, where he was previously a principal lecturer. And I know he does quite a lot of lecturing too in the University of Oxford. He writes and speaks widely on environmental issues. But it's a double act tonight because Margot, his wife, is a reverend doctor. Or a reverend. Sorry. Well, you can take an honorary doctorate for this evening.
An honorary one.
She is rector of, is it Wychurt or
Wychurt?
Wychurt, thank you. Vale Benefice, which is six churches in Buckinghamshire. She was previously chaplain of Jesus College, Oxford, and she is the JR representative on the board of Arusha, UK. Between them, the Hodgsons have published quite a lot of books, including A Christian Guide to Environmental Issues, which I suspect they'll tell you they put a bookstall at the back, so you can have a look. Anyway, it's a great pleasure to welcome them both tonight to talk on sustainable agriculture in a rapidly changing world, and that's the sixth in our Fragile Planet series. So, Martin, I think you're starting.
Yep.
Well.
Well, thank you very much for inviting us to speak to you this evening. It's great to see such a good audience. What are we going to do? The plan. I thought what we will do is we'll look, first of all, at basically the problems of doing agriculture now. Then I'll take you through some of what I think are the solutions, and they're a personal selection of solutions rather than every solution, so don't expect your pet solution necessarily to come up, because there isn't time to do them all in something like this. And then Margot will come at the end to do a short theological reflection. So it's going to be mostly me, but with the best bit for the end with Margot. Right. So we're going to start with human population. Very interesting. I do a lot of talks on climate change, and every time when I do a talk on climate change, the question from the audience comes, but isn't it actually human population which is the problem? And you can see it's really growing really quite rapidly. And if you look at world population growth, you can see that 10,000 years ago, there were just a few million of us, but it's been growing very rapidly, particularly recently. And so we now reckon that there's around about 7.7 billion people on the planet. That's 7,700 million. And that is more than double in my lifetime, and indeed in almost everybody's lifetime here. So that is a huge and rapid growth. Where is population highest? Well, it is very definitely highest in China and India, where they have over a billion people each. And then it's spread around the rest of the world. And Africa doesn't look too bad here, but all the population demographers say that that is where the big growth is likely to be, that we're going to see big growth, perhaps a billion extra people in Africa very shortly, which could be really seriously problematic. How does population actually interact with the environment? Well, of course, if we're going to feed ourselves, we need land for agriculture. And so we chop down forests. We've chopped down a lot of the forests in Europe, and we're busily chopping them down in places like Brazil, the rainforests and so on. And we just need that land for growing crops. We also need land for housing. And you'll be aware that throughout the south of England, I know it's happening in Bristol, it's happening where we are, there is a lot of housing going up at the moment. A lot of that, sadly, on pretty good agricultural land. And I do have serious worries about that for the future. So we need land for housing. And, of course, a big population means we're going to need more housing. We also need increased resources. So, for instance, energy, water, all kinds of things we need more of if we are having a bigger population. And carbon emissions. You would imagine with more people that there will be more carbon emissions. And we'll see a little, I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. It's not totally straightforward. But is there a limit on population, an upper limit? It seems like there should be. And if you have done any basic ecology courses sometime in the past, you might remember the carrying capacity. Yep, there are a few people nodding in the audience, and I remember it well. And carrying capacity is basically the number of animals or whatever that you can fit into an area that will give them enough food to survive on. And that is actually the carrying capacity is determined basically by the food supply. We are unusual in that we've got agricultural technology, so no other animals have got agricultural technology, but our technology allows us to do things, grow things, more things than you would normally expect. Now that does have, of course, knock-on bad impacts, but it does. We've also got political, cultural, and social type restrictions which play into this upper limit. And so it's not as straightforward as for your average lemming. Estimates of the carrying capacity vary a lot. I think most people say we could probably get 10 billion in if we were careful and everything was sensible on the planet. We're expecting, though, 9 billion pretty quickly by around about 2050. So it's going to be pretty quick. People, again, with climate change lectures often say, ah, well, there's a relationship between population and climate change. And indeed, this is some old data, but there is a kind of a relationship, but it is not a simple relationship. We in this room emit a lot more carbon dioxide than those people living in, say, Bangladesh or the developing world. And so although their populations may be rising quite rapidly, we're the ones who do most of the emissions. So if we have fairly large families, then we're going to be producing a lot of very heavy carbon emitters. And so it's not a direct relationship between numbers of people and global warming. But there is a bit of one. Okay, so we've mentioned climate change. Now, I know that you've already had some very good speakers already talking about climate change, but I think in this context, it's obviously an important thing to have a quick look at, to just say, what is the other problem? So we've got all these mouths to feed, more and more mouths, but at the same time, we're all aware that climate change is clicking in quite quickly. Most of you will have been around in 1976, I was, and I remember it as being a very, very hot summer. And you can see there, 1976, if you look at the red spot, it's over Western Europe and over the UK. But most of the rest of the planet is nice and relatively cool. And people said after 2018, last summer, oh, you know, well, wasn't it a bit like 1976? Well, have a look at 2018. That is the difference. you can see the red spot is a lot bigger over Western Europe, but a lot of the planet is red spot. Look down at the Antarctic. Temperatures are at between 4 and 6 degrees C, higher than they normally should be. And that's the difference that's happened in almost all of our lifetimes, right? 1976 to 2018. That's what we're really looking at. The 10 hottest years. This is up to date at the moment. And you can see that they're nearly all since 2000, the exception being 1998, which was an El Niño year, which is this warm current in the Pacific, which produces warmer years. 2015 and 2016 were extraordinary, but they were El Niño years. And so they were really, really, they were warm because of that, but more warm because of our carbon dioxide. 2017, though, was the year that really worried the climate scientists the most, because that was not an El Niño year. That was a kind of normal year, if you like, and look where it was. Now, we would have had 2018's data, but as you might realize, NOAA and NASA are American institutions, and because of the Trump shutdown, we haven't got the 2018 data yet, but everybody is saying it's likely to come in at around about the fourth warmest, So it's heating up very rapidly, and that is really worrying. However, there are people who say, oh, don't worry about it. And if you go on to Australian climate skeptic blogs, you will see CO2. I was framed, Your Honour. I find you innocent of all charges, says Your Honour. I'm a plant scientist. Carbon dioxide is a nutrient for plants. And in fact, you will use carbon dioxide regularly in horticulture. Say you're growing tomatoes, you release carbon dioxide in the greenhouse, and you get better growth of the plants. So the climate skeptics quite often say, it's better for us. We're going to get better growth of plants. And indeed, it looks like we are in some places. If you look at this, this is the projected changes in agriculture by 2080, you will see that a lot of the northern hemisphere, where we are, is actually fairly green, which means that we're going to get something maybe 15% increase in agricultural production. But, there is a big but, there is a negative impact of all the other things that happen due to climate change. So you've got heat waves, droughts, floods, hurricanes, all of these things have a huge negative impact. So even though the carbon dioxide might be going up and the growth might increase a bit under some conditions, all these other things knock the growth down again. And so you can see where the big problems are. And sadly, again, a lot of it is Africa. A lot of it is Africa. South America gets hit as well, India. Interestingly, the southern United States doesn't look to be doing too well. That could be quite interesting. If you look at the countries most likely to survive climate change, it's not that too dissimilar a map. We, you'll be pleased to hear, are always in the top 10 nations in the world for surviving climate change. They do the calculations based on two things. One, how rich the country is, and two, on the climatology of the country. So if it's got a decent climate and it's reasonably well off, you're going to be high up the list. If you've got a fairly arid climate already and you're poor, you're going to be down near the bottom. And you can see that we're pretty good. Scandinavia is great. Often Canada comes out well. New Zealand is off the map, as it often is, but actually New Zealand's a really good place to be. It's interesting Australia comes out pretty well, but you have to remember that they are a rich country and they can survive climate change easier. You will be aware, of course, that There was a big climate change report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, last November, which was looking at 1.5 degrees C. Remember, we've already had about 1 degree C above the pre-industrial temperature. So this is only another half of a degree. And they were looking to see what we would need to do. And we need to do a lot. And we need to do it really, really quickly. There is this meme going around that the climate scientists really hate, which is we've got 12 years to save the planet. And I don't think that's right. But we have got about 10 or 12 years to radically reduce our carbon emissions. Otherwise, a whole lot of nasty things really start happening very quickly. And so that is the message. It's really quite worrying on climate change. So we've got more mouths to feed and we've got climate change clicking in at the same time. Third problem is agricultural land. There is only so much land. 38.4% is agricultural land at the moment, but there's only so much land that you can use for agriculture. There's mountains, there's really cold regions, there's deserts, all kinds of places you cannot actually use for agriculture. So we're currently using 38.4%. Now, we could increase that a bit, but if we did, then we're likely to see further decreases in biodiversity. So we'll be cutting down more and more of the rainforests and more of these areas, which we would really like to preserve. Another report which came out towards the end of 2018 was the WWF report, which you might have seen, which looked at biodiversity loss. And from between 1970 and 2014, we had a decline of 60% of the numbers of animals, basically. Not the numbers of species, but the actual populations. So it is massive. It is huge. And if we start growing onto more agricultural, if we expand our agricultural land more into these rainforests and areas, we're going to see even more loss of biodiversity. So you can see those are the problems in a way. We've got the problem of mouths to feed, increased numbers. We've got the problem of climate change clicking in very rapidly, and we've got the problem that we haven't got very much more land that we can use, and if we do use it, we're going to devastate what remains of our biodiversity. So that's the nasty bit. Now what about the solutions? Right, solutions. GM crops. Yes, an interesting topic, this one. I have the interesting position of being both a plant scientist and an environmentalist. Most of my plant scientist colleagues are very pro-GM crops. Most of my environmentalist colleagues are very anti-GM crops. I tend to take a kind of a middle position, I think. What I think is a middle position. In fact, I once ended up being invited to the Houses of Parliament to speak. And they asked me to come and speak. And they said, because you're in the church, we think you will give a balanced presentation. Which was kind of touching, really. But so I did. And I went and I did the talk. And it was quite interesting because there was one guy who was obviously from the industry. And everything about GM crops was absolutely perfect. And at the other end, we got a guy who said, well, touch any GM crops and you'll get cancer immediately, that sort of thing. It was really that range, you know. And I was going right down the middle and said, well, you did what you were told. Right. Now, I've had an interest in GM crops for quite a long time because I did my PhD, my doctorate, on salt tolerance in grasses in the late 70s, early 80s. And during that time, this book appeared, Genetic Engineering of Osmoregulation, Impact on Plant Productivity for for food, chemicals, and energy. And I've still got it. And I cited it widely in my thesis. And it was saying, we're going to have salt-tolerant and drought-tolerant crops, which will solve all the problems of these arid lands. That was 1980. Next year is 2020. That's 40 years on. There are still no commercially available salt-tolerant or drought-tolerant crops. Very interesting. I'll tell you why I think that is a bit later. Where are the current GM crops grown? Now, this is from the industry. It tells you where the GM crops are grown. It's quite a nice sort of graphic. You can see immediately there's quite a lot over in the Americas. There's a little bit in Spain and Portugal, and the Far East has got quite a lot. But I found this rather a complicated graph to really work out what was going on. And so I decided I would add up all the figures for areas that are actually being grown. And this is what you actually get if you add up the figures. And you can see that North America and Latin America are huge for GM crops. Asia and Australia are reasonable. Africa, relatively small. And Europe, you can hardly see the red line. And that is essentially because the European Union have made it quite complicated. It's not impossible to grow GM crops, but also that the general public don't like them. Right across Europe, there is a real feeling of not liking them, rightly or wrongly. Global area of biotech crops. You can see that they've been going up since they were introduced in 1996. They've been going up globally, and they've been going up in industrial countries and in developing countries. I think, though, I might be wrong, but I've got a feeling it's slightly levelling off. It looks to me to be somewhat levelling off. What are the crops? Well, there are four big ones: cotton, soybean, maize, and canola, which we call oilseed rape. And you can see that actually 80% of the cotton that is grown is GM, and 77% of the soybeans, less maize, about a third, and about a third of the canola. So those are the four big ones. Note that there is no wheat. There is no wheat that's grown. That's GM. What are the GM crops? Well, these are the GM crops. There are really two main types. There is herbicide resistant and insect resistant. And then the orange line, which is called stacked traits, means that they've got both. So they've got both herbicide resistance and insect resistance. And you can see that they have been largely going up. Those are the two big ones. 99% plus of the GM crops grown around the world are those two. You might ask, well, why is it that it's those two? And the reason is that they're pretty easy to do in biochemical terms, genetic terms. Something like drought tolerance. Drought tolerance in maize is controlled by about 70 different genes that are all interacting with each other in very complex ways. So it's very difficult to pin things down. The other thing that you have to remember is that you've got your cactus growing on your windowsill, right? And it doesn't grow very quickly, does it? Well, the truth of the matter is that most plants that grow in those very arid environments grow slowly. And so what has happened when people have introduced genes for tolerance into a lot of the crops is that it slows the growth down and it slows you don't get as much production. So that's why we've still got, I mean, they're still experimenting on it, and they're still saying it's going to happen, but it hasn't actually happened. yet. What are the problems? Problems of GM crops. I think I always say that there are four. There are what you might call ethical and religious problems. I won't go into the whole lot. But I think for me, as a scientist and a Christian and an environmentalist, I don't have too much objection if people are moving genes from one plant to another. That could quite possibly have happened quite naturally. I start to get worried. I can't actually pin down why, and it's not necessarily logical, but I say, when we start moving, say, a fish gene for an antifreeze into a plant, I don't quite like it. And I don't know what it is, but there's something which says that's not right. Now, you can argue with me, but it isn't a logical thing. It's just a feeling that it's not right. Food problems. Frankenstein foods, that sort of thing. You'll hear that quite often. To be honest, the evidence is really not there. I don't think the food problem is as big as a lot of people think it is. There is, every so often you'll hear somebody who's come up with something which says it is a problem. But on the whole, I think this is probably the least of the problems with GM crops. Now, it's not to say it couldn't be a problem in the future if somebody did something stupid, but at the moment, I don't think it is. Environmental problems. Yes, there are environmental problems. Obviously, with herbicide resistance, it actually encourages more use of herbicides. And then you've got insect resistance. And actually, we're already beginning to get insects that are tolerant to the plants, that sort of thing. And we're also seeing examples where the genes are starting to escape into weeds, which is a bit of a problem. So there is difficulties with the environment. But to my mind, the biggest problem of the lot is what you might call the globalization problem. I can't go into it in detail here. But a few very large companies hold the power in GM crops, one in particular. And I find that rather worrying myself. But it's going on, and we're now moving having genetic modification where you're taking quite large chunks from one plant or an animal into a plant, but we're actually seeing things like gene editing, which is much more precise. And you might have seen this article in The Guardian just very recently, 5 genetically modified fruit. And some of them look fantastic. CRISPR gene editing techniques, brilliant. Again, though, the European Union is not that keen on them by the sounds of things. And they're basically putting them under the same category as the GM crops. So we'll have to see how that moves forward. It's a relatively recent sort of phenomenon. Other sorts of solutions. I've done GM crops, which I know a reasonable amount about because I've done a lot on it. Other solutions. Well, we could go in for geoengineering. And I think the solar radiation management ideas, I think that's if we get desperate. To be absolutely honest, those are things which could be deployed in 30 or more years' time if we really are seeing the planet beginning to fry. But that's a desperation measure. The others are more possible, but all of them, with the exception perhaps of reforestation, all of them have potential other negative impacts. So the idea of fertilizing the oceans with iron to create algal growth, which then sucks the carbon dioxide down, what else is it going to do? You know, it's all of that kind of thing. But there are a lot of these geoengineering techniques around, and I think they're worth investigating. I think they're worth doing. But we always have to be aware of the potential problems. What about vertical agriculture? Instead of expanding agricultural out horizontally, let's go upwards. And this, I think, has got real potential. Obviously, you're not going to be getting the same kind of organic crops and things like this. They're going to be very regulated, often with hydroponics and so on. But in a method of producing food without using large amounts of land, it does seem to have a lot to go for it. And I couldn't resist this. We were even discussing it a little bit at dinner this evening. A bit of meat, a lot of veg. The flexitarian diet to feed 10 billion. It is true that cattle and sheep, ruminants in general, actually release a lot of methane. And they have all sorts of other impacts. And so I think actually there is a very good case for cutting down on meat consumption. We have actually done that ourselves. We're not vegetarians or vegans, but we eat a lot of vegetarian and vegan, and then occasionally have a steak or something like that from our local butcher with a really good quality stuff. So you don't buy the poor stuff, you save up and buy the good stuff. Right. So that's a somewhat controversial, but I think opinions are changing on this, and I think it is something that we really do need to look at, changing our diet, and that could help a lot. Finally, yep, I'm on track, I'm doing well. Right, solution, carbon sequestration in the soil. The idea is quite simple. Soil contains a massive amount of carbon, much more than the atmosphere, actually. And you can see the idea is the carbon dioxide is trapped by the plants, and then the roots release the carbon, or the leaves drop into the soil and the carbon goes into the soil. We end up with a pool of soil carbon. But the problem is that once it gets into the soil, it gets broken down pretty rapidly to release carbon dioxide back to the atmosphere again. So it would be really good to find methods where you could actually get more of the carbon to stay in soil for longer. And one of the methods, compost is one, but one really good method that there's been a lot of investigations of is something called biochar. And you produce biochar basically with pyrolysis. It's high temperature and pressure and low oxygen, and then you produce this charcoal-type material, which then you can put into the soil, and it will stay there for quite a long time. So, but it's not sure whether it's going to work. We're not sure whether it's going to work. Tell you now about a bit of my research, which I've been, as Margot knows, onto this all this year, and we've often had discussions about it at 2 or 3 in the morning. I'm sure those of you who are scientists or scientist spouses know this phenomenon. a little bit about my research and how this actually plays out. This is pampas grass, and you might know that pampas grass, if you try to pull the leaves, you're going to get cut. They've got very, very sharp leaves indeed. And on the edge of the leaves, you can just see on that bottom right diagram picture, there are little prickles. The little prickles are made of silica. And if you went and took scanning the electron micrograph of them, you'd see that they're like that. And so that's what will cut you when you pull up a piece of grass. Not just pampas grass, but a whole lot of other species will do this as well. And I have actually spent a large part of my career working on these beasties called phytoliths, which almost nobody has ever heard of. Phyton, plant, lithos, rock, plant, stones, yep. And they're quite natural in plants. And that's what you would find in the cell walls. You can see the pinkish stuff is the silica. And that's the cell wall type. And those beasties come from the cell lumen. And you can see really interesting shapes. They've filled the whole cell with silica. And these things can last for hundreds or thousands of years in the soil. And you can use them, and I've used them in collaboration with archaeologists and paleoecologists and paleoclimatologists to work out past vegetation and what we were eating and that sort of stuff. As it happens, I did some work some years ago. This is probably my most famous paper, Phylogenetic Variation of Silicon in Plants. And what we did was we looked, it was kind of a big meta-analysis of every plant silicon concentration we could find. And this is all of the angiosperms, the flowering plants. And you can see that's the grasses up there. So they're the highest ones. They accumulate the most, and that's why you cut your hands on it. Now, it's a defense mechanism against grazing, against pathogens, all that sort of thing. But the question one might want to ask is, can phytoliths save the world? Of course, having worked on phytoliths for 40 years, the answer is definitely yes, as you would imagine. Now, more seriously, soil is a huge carbon store. It's a massive, massive carbon store. But, as we've seen, when the leaves fall off the trees, they go into the soil, they rot, the carbon goes back up again. There is carbon trapped in those phytoliths. We know it, I've measured it. It's not big, but it's a reasonable amount. And, as I say, they stay in the soil for hundreds or thousands of years. In fact, we've even found them associated with dinosaurs in the coprolites, the dung of dinosaurs. We've found them. Now, of course, by then, most of the carbon will have disappeared and they'll have got fossilized, but they must have hung around long enough to get fossilized in the first place, of course. So they survive hundreds or thousands of years in the soil. Could we possibly increase that? Could we actually increase it? And there is evidence that if you look at wheat, where we've got quite a lot of different cultivars, that there is cultivar differences. There are cultivar differences in the amount of carbon that's stored in the phytoliths. Could we breed for it? Interesting. Interesting stuff. So have we actually got natural carbon capture and storage that we could actually make a bit of use out of? Well, I'm working on it. We've brought a bookstall, as mentioned at the back. For those of you that are new to this kind of area, the environment area, we wrote a book a couple of years back. Margot and I wrote A Christian Guide to Environmental Issues, which actually looks at all of the issues we've looked at tonight. So I've got a chapter on human population, we've got a chapter on food, we've got a chapter on soil, water, and then, so I do simple introduction to science for each of the issues, and then Margot does a theological reflection. And I've allowed Margot plenty of time, so here we go. Right, at that point, I'll hang it over to Margot. You are.
Thank you.
Right, that's the forward. Yep.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. It's lovely to be here. I used to live in Bristol. I was actually born here, grew up in Somerset, and then came back for university and stayed on to teach. And it's really nice to be back. Well, I want to tell you a little bit about Isaiah. While Martin was waking up at 3 a.m. and I could see this thought bubble with a phytolith in it, I was thinking about Isaiah and how we could actually use the images in Isaiah of the natural world to understand more about the way God wants us to respond to our natural world. Now, Isaiah is just full of natural images. There are about 150 mentions of animals in the book, and they're by different species. There are 3 species of owls mentioned in Isaiah, which is amazing. And I found that these images really, were very, very vivid, very powerful. And I actually began to think, how could I use them? How could I understand them? Because you didn't want sort of lightning conduct from, you know, trees clapping their hands to say, well, that's what God wants us to do with trees. They should clap their hands. So it was that there had to be something in the middle. And I remembered when I was back in Bristol studying geography that there was a school of thought developing about perceptual analysis, which was how did people perceive their natural environment? And one of my contemporaries actually used this on Thomas Hardy's books to see how did he perceive landscape. And I thought, wow, I think I could use it to see how Isaiah and the people of that day perceived the natural world. And all these images, they're used to develop theological themes. And actually they reveal something about how they saw the natural world. And those ideas are developed in the New Testament, which I haven't got much time to talk about that. I might be able to just mention it. Well, first of all, I want to explain the context of it. You know, I believe very much these texts were inspired, and I think it's really good to see who God was inspiring. Come from around about the 8th to 6th centuries BC, that's the New Iron Age, so that's the sort of where it fits in. The land of Canaan, where the Israelites were, was Maqui. It's the land of milk and honey. It's not the coastal plains of Mesopotamia, which were very fertile and rich, but it was up in the hills. This is a rather beautiful painting of it. And it's a place where you could kind of graze your goats and sheep. You might do a little bit of, a tiny bit of cereal farming, not very much. Mostly you had pasture land with lots of herb species, so your goats and sheep gave you milk, your herb species were full of bees and that gave you honey, and you could also grow vines and various trees that produced, you know, figs, olives, almonds. That's what you had, that's where they were. And that is the landscape that these people were living in. Very, very interesting, the work I did actually, I felt really showed that the Isaiah 40 onwards, which some people say was written in Babylonia, was almost certainly written in Canaan. It's so full of the images from that part of the world. So what images did I look at? I looked at just several marker ones because I thought if I took 6 specific ones and looked at them, I could trace them through. And there were these 6 things that you could actually look at and see how were these images treated? How did the people use them? And this is what I found, so I came up with. First of all, in the first part of Isaiah, which goes up to Isaiah 39, which is the kind of darker bit, if you like. There's some very positive patches, like Isaiah 11, but some very grim ones, like chapter 24, where everything seems to go wrong, beginning part of it. There's quite a lot of tough speaking in that part of Isaiah. And what seemed to be coming through was that this wonderful world that God had created should be full of God's glory, but actually it was under judgment. And because of that, you had war, you had drought, you had poor crops, and you had thorns and briars and all sorts of species that were not productive, if you like. But it wasn't saying that this world is a horrible place that we must escape from, which is a narrative you get in some strands of Christianity down through the ages. It wasn't saying that at all. It was saying, actually, nature is not to blame. Nature is not the problem. Nature is not inherently sinful. It's humans who've actually caused the problem. And it's the breakdown of relationships between humans and God that has led to a breakdown of relationships between humans and each other. And that has led down a breakdown in relationships between humans and the rest of God's creation. And that's what you have in that picture. And if you want to, you know, the pinnacle of that probably is chapter 24, if you want to sort of read an example chapter. That's what you see in first part of Isaiah. Injustice towards other people, particularly the vulnerable, and then injustice towards the land. But then there's a change. That's when we've just come through Christmas. You know, if you ever hear Messiah, comfort ye, my people. And the second and third parts of Isaiah 40 onwards, you see something very different. That's Western Burt, if you've ever been to it. Beautiful, beautiful place, not too far away. You see lots of images of rejoicing and fruitfulness. The earth, the holy mountain of God, is full of glory. It's God's dwelling place. Both those images are with. Sometimes it's the earth, sometimes it's mountain. And that results from the restored relationship between humans and God. There's a direct link between people coming back to God and those relationships coming back together, and you see this fruitfulness in creation. And from there, going into the particularly the last part of Isaiah, you see the renewal of creation. You see, you know, the renewed heaven and earth coming through. You see something very special happening. And this promise of restoration looking forward into the future, not simply in the present. So that's the kind of, in a nutshell, if you like, what I kind of gleaned of how things were being perceived. Another dimension to it that I think is really relevant today when looking at agriculture is to look at the difference between wilderness and farming and what was going on. Because I was very aware that in many sort of traditional cultures, the sort of ideal future when everything is kind of in harmony is one of wilderness. And I was thinking, well, actually, is that what you're getting in Isaiah? And it was very interesting what I found out. This is Mount Rundle up in the Rockies, one of my favourite parts of the world. I've only ever been there once. But what you see and what Isaiah was perceiving, and I think what God was working with his people, is that the wilderness is a very special place. And it's a very special place because it's the place where humans can meet with God, where creation flourishes in God's presence. It might be a desert, it might be a mountain, but it's the place of that meeting. Jesus went to the desert to pray. He went up the mountain, was transfigured. Roses went up the mountain to meet with God. Those are the places of meeting. But, take you into the Cotswolds. It's actually the farmed land that in Isaiah, it's perceived that you go back to work everything out, to go back to your working life, to go back to working out those relationships and making them work. But not in an abusive way, in a harmonious way. And the Bible is full of teaching, particularly books like Leviticus, Deuteronomy, teaching on how you should behave towards the land, towards each other, and towards God. So actually, when you get the eschatological future, you know, that future bit at the end of Isaiah, it's not a wilderness that you're there meeting with God and everything's wonderful and perfect. You're actually under your own fig tree. You're with your own vine. You have your own crops. It's a very agricultural image that you see. And I thought that was quite interesting. And not surprising for, if you like, New Iron Age farmers. But you think, well, where was this going as they were listening to God and as God was drawing them to write this text? I think we can draw several things from it. First of all, I think you see that there's a redemption that leads to future harmony. There's definitely that sense of that awful bit of the beginning of Isaiah coming through to this really amazing redemption, that there's something happening there. And in the New Testament, that's mirrored in Romans 8, if you look at that. It's mirrored in Revelation. It's mirrored in places like Colossians 1. You see it coming through, redemption leading to future harmony. A very strong sense of intrinsic worth. Nature is valuable in its own right, not because it's useful to humans. And that's one of the things I think this whole, you know, our whole generation need to grasp. Nature is valuable in its own right. I've said already about wilderness meeting with God, but that's not where you work. You actually work by fulfilling our role to take responsibility, to lead creation, as in Genesis 1, and to work in creation and enable it to flourish, and God will bless that harmony. So finally, what can we learn from Isaiah? Quite a lot, I think. There are these positive images of cultivation, which is great. And I think it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing research on GM. I think it does mean that we should be careful if the genes are escaping and wiping out the native gene pool, or if it means that we can spray too much herbicide on things. But there are positive images of creation. It's not wrong to use our science, to use our agricultural ability to engage with creation. That's not a wrong thing. It's not wrong to use our science to try and engage with climate change and do things back. That's what God wants us to do. That's how he's created us. But to do so in a way that's positive for creation. When we get that sense of harmony, when we work for it, we get flourishing. And that's where sustainability is all about. That's where the sustainability goals are all about internationally. When we work for those, we see flourishing. And I think that's something we should be working towards. It's something that's holistic. So much in our world is anthropocentric, is what is good for humans. So much of our Christian ethics is anthropocentric. What is it to do with humans and the relationship between humans and God? Man-centric, centered on. And actually, God wants us to be more holistic. God wants us to think about the natural world as well. God wants to take us out of center stage, because it's God who's center stage, and then to see the whole picture more fully. If we do that, we can build a responsible ethic for conservationists that is interventionist. And by that, I don't mean it in a heavy-handed way, but that does engage. When I was here, I was teaching at Cotton Grammar, and we had a New Zealander over for a year, and I used to do conservation down on the Mendips, and I'd coppice trees. And he was horrified that you chop down trees at doing conservation, because they had a much more sort of preservationist approach. It's more interventionist now, but at that time, you know, to stand back. But actually, it's good to intervene when it actually helps nature flourish. Coppice the trees on the Mendips, you get the the light brings all the plants, because that's how it's been worked agriculturally. So what you have in this book, I think, and in the stewardship ethic that comes through from the Hebrew Bible, is a really valuable tool to actually take action in this century. Because it's saying that as Christians, we should be engaging with our world to see ways in which we can go forward. And, you know, as scientists and others, we should be using those skills to see how we can take things forward. And that's a really positive thing. The challenge is how we do it. And there's a rabbi who's very, very much involved in the environmental movement. And he said every time he'd go to a synagogue in someone like New York, they'd build a rainforest for him. And it was all about leaving nature untouched. He said it's not about how you leave nature untouched. It's how you touch nature. And that's the central challenge of our time. And that's what I'll leave it with you, because that's the challenge of Isaiah, that we do touch nature. How do we do it? How do we use our skills? And how do we do that to work towards the harmony that God is calling us to, and give others that vision that God has for the way he would like his world to be restored and renewed? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Well worth a double act, and we're extremely grateful. So thank you both very much. I hope you're happy now to have some time for questions. We haven't got a nice handheld mic, so I'm going to give Tina this to go round. So if you put your hand up, I'll point to people, and she can go and find you. And I can see that David has got...
Martin, thank you, and Margot too. Thank you for your talks. Can I ask a question about soil? You showed a picture of vertical food production. My question is, do we know enough about soil to know how to grow healthy food without soil? In other words, what do we put in the aquaculture system to ensure that we're not losing essential trace elements and so on?
Well, thanks for the question. The answer is we know actually a lot. I've worked on hydroponics when I was doing my doctorate onwards, and we know all of the elements, more or less, that are needed for plants. Every so often we've added an extra one because they're needed in very, very low amounts. So the last one that was definitely added was nickel, which nobody was really expecting to be an essential element for plants, but it turned out that it is, but it's required in really, really small amounts. Oddly, silicon, my favourite, is not actually down as one of the essential elements. It's down in this category known as beneficial elements. But yeah, we do know a lot, so we can actually grow plants in hydroponics very well because we know exactly what's going on. And in fact, hydroponics is actually a much simpler system to control than soil is. It's really much, much easier to do things in hydroponics. Thank you.
When vegetable matter goes into the soil and decays, You said that carbon dioxide is returned to the atmosphere. Does that mean that planting trees is a pointless thing to do?
The planting trees, is it a pointless thing to do? No, it isn't, because they do store carbon for quite a long time. And so a lot of the carbon offsetting schemes, like Climate Stewards, the Christian one, they're planting a lot of trees. And they are storing a lot of carbon for hundreds of years. And actually, I think we need to be looking at how we can store carbon maybe for 100 years or so. That would be really good if we could find a way of storing lots of carbon, taking it out of the atmosphere and even keeping it for that sort of length of time. You don't need thousands of years, but we need some sort of way of doing it. So yeah, planting trees is actually good, but yes, you're right, eventually they will die, they go into the soil and they rot and then the carbon is released. But if you can slow that down, so much the better, which is why I mentioned the phytoliths. But yeah, it's a good idea, but it will help things. Yeah.
Martin, thank you both very much indeed for that. I'm actually just going to do something I feel slightly uneasy about, because whenever I'm talking and someone tells me, but you didn't mention, I get really upset because it wasn't within my brief. But forgive me. My very good friend from Oxford, I don't know if you know John Guillebeau.
Yeah, yeah.
John has spoken to you before.
Yep.
John would suggest that one of the things you quite haven't mentioned, and I think we should, is population control.
Yeah, yeah.
Population control has got to be in that. And so forgive me for pointing that out, but I think it's an important thing just to mention.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we know John Guillebeau quite well. In fact, he used to go to the same church as us in Oxford. And he has actually ended up, he actually wrote in some of our publications. In fact, the one we've got here, he's got a section in it on that very topic. Oh, it's going really haywire. Yeah, and so, yeah, you're dead right. I mean, you know, he came and spoke at one of our conferences, really quite amusing. He spoke on population, on population control and that sort of thing. And then there was a lady who said, we were missionaries out in Africa, and we saw these nuns going around distributing contraceptives. And they went up to the nuns and said, hold on, what will Rome think about this? So, Rome is a long way away from us. Yeah, so yeah, we are aware of that, but it's basically time and how you can fit everything in.
Question? One right over there, and then one back here. No, it needs to be recorded. You'll be there for posterity.
Hi, I was just wondering, so I've read the John Lawton report et al. That says there's only 100 years left in our soils, and that's to do with the lack of organic matter. Yep. So I know there's a lot in agriculture to do with minimum tillage, to do with burying stubble, turning it over. How does that then work with the carbon if you've got no soil?
If you've got no soil, you are in trouble, and you are dead right. We're losing soil at a phenomenal rate around the world. So in actual fact, the sorts of things, the minimum tillage and so on, is the idea where you don't plough, because ploughing is actually really bad, because it actually releases. You expose the carbon to the atmosphere, the bugs get going, and you release a whole lot of it into the atmosphere. If you just keep you don't plough and you drill into the soil, you're going to release a lot less. So a lot of those kind of techniques. Soil erosion, big problem. Yeah, I mean, around the world, we are losing soil at a really big rate. And that, of course, means that actually quite a lot of our agricultural land is actually getting less and less good and is going to end up being unusable. Another problem to add to that, and you can't do all the problems, but salinization, particularly in arid zones, is a really serious problem. And whole areas of agricultural land are going out of production because of salinization due to poor irrigation practices most of the time. So yeah, you're dead right. I mean, you know, we're losing soil and we're losing carbon from soil at a really big rate. But you see, actually, that's why the sort of stuff we were talking about, bringing more carbon into the soil, that will actually help stick it together, because that's what sticks the soil particles together, is the organic matter. So yeah, it'd be really helpful. Thank you.
Martin, thank you very much. As an engineer, I have to look to mechanical means to achieve solutions. So to see a natural proposal for carbon capture is fantastic. I just wondered whether there's any research or understanding of the energy balance and the energy required to capture the, because that's perhaps the principal challenge that we have with mechanical means, is the energy burden to bring the carbon out the environment into the earth. So have you considered that and looked into that
in terms of the phytoliths?
Yes, for the phytoliths, yeah.
No, I've never actually really considered it. There are quite a lot of interesting papers on the balance between silica and, say, lignin, a very strong material which is in wood. And you might, some of you will know scouring rush, Equisetum. It's a very ancient plant, and it's absolutely full of silica. But the Equisetums we've got now are about this sort of size, maximum up to around about here. But they used to be massive trees. The problem was that the way they stayed upright was because of their silica. And of course they got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then the whole branches would drop off because of the weight of the silica. So when plants invented, in inverted commas, lignin, which was much lighter and very strong, that's when trees really started to take off, and they outcompeted the poor Equisetums, and now all we've got left are the small ones. So there are some things like that, but I don't think we've ever done. I mean, the truth is that the whole idea of carbon sequestration in phytoliths actually only goes back to 2005, the actual idea of using it in that way. And the research is really still changing very rapidly. I mean, there's a lot of interest in it, but I don't think anybody's ever done energetics on it. But I don't think it will be problematic for grasses. They do it quite naturally. You know, we can get up to 10% of the dry weight of a plant silica quite naturally. Nobody's tried it yet, but it might be worth it. Hello.
I want to question myself.
Yeah.
So in Bristol, there's quite a movement of people to have their own allotments. There's a city farm at St. Werburgh's, Tinsfield, you know, they've got a kitchen garden. And is that kind of thing helpful? I mean, what are we trying to do as a city that would, you know, that would sort of alleviate some of this?
I'll bring in my expert on allotments.
I think allotments are a really good idea. We've got allotments in our village, and there's even a waiting list. And they're an excellent idea because for several reasons. One is if you're eating the food off your allotment, you're not flying it in from South Africa or something, or you're not trucking it in, or you know, buying it from somebody who's headed up to Heathrow or something to buy it. So it's very local, so your carbon footprint is much lower. But also, if you're up there working on your allotment, you're not in your car going off to somewhere else. And so actually, you've got a much lower carbon footprint. And if you're on your allotment, you are making friends with people locally who are also on the allotments and probably can walk there, get there quite easily. And so you're making a community that's a stronger and more resilient community. And so I think from all sorts of angles, and it's good for you and it's healthy, and if you have a surplus, you know, then you can give it away to other people. So I think it's a very, you know, a very, very positive thing to do it. And, you know, I'm not terribly good at, I'm good at growing apples and palm. My excuse is a very large sycamore tree, but I think it's a really good thing.
I want to put in a word for wood. You mentioned that wood rots when it gets back into the soil. But it doesn't rot if it's kept above the soil and kept dry. Mm. And it doesn't rot if it's submerged in anaerobic conditions.
Yep.
So what do you have any sort of hope there for actually retaining wood and stopping it rotting? Is there anything at large scale which could be done?
Well, buildings.
Building
you can see all around us, there are, and that is a true thing. You know, if we built more things out of wood, I mean, obviously you've got to think about fire regulations and that sort of thing, and fire retardants and whatever. Mm. But you know, if we could keep wood above ground and not have it rot. That would be a very good thing. And I think
quite a lot of carbon capture and storage going on, actually.
Yeah, I would say good.
Can I come in with a question? There was one over there as well. Yeah, I'll just ask mine, then we'll have one over there. Fungi.
Yeah.
Great source of food.
Yep.
Are they environmentally friendly?
I think the answer has to be yes, because they are quite quite natural.
I'm thinking more that they're being used a lot now in making things like quorum and so on, bacteria and fungi to make edible foods.
Depends how they're grown.
Yeah, it depends. It depends quite considerable extent how they're grown and where they're grown and whatever. But yeah, fungi have a distinct role to play in our diet, and I don't see any problem with them. I mean, it's quite interesting, actually. Vegans, the rule about vegans is just simply that you don't eat animals. Now, actually, if you're a molecular geneticist, actually, fungi tend to be more closely related to animals than to plants. So it's kind of interesting the way things have worked out. But anyway.
I don't think they're sentient, are they?
They're not sentient, as far as we know.
Getting me?
Yep. Yeah, try
again. Christians are taught in the Bible that in the latter days and in the end times, there will come a time when the entire world is deceived by somebody known as the Antichrist. So I think that the idea of very colossal deception should not be unfamiliar to Christians. And from my own findings and research, I assert that the entire idea of carbon being a danger to us is a part of such a deception and is working strongly towards the total global control system under the Antichrist that the Bible itself indicates is coming. You said that it's not wrong to use science to deal with climate change, but I would assert that it certainly is wrong to use science to deal with climate change if it is a fraudulent paradigm in the first place.
You're a theologian.
Well, I think you've got two issues here. One is where is the deception? And is climate change real? And the other is, you know, how does the Bible ask us to respond? And I think I'll leave Martin to talk about the climate change issue in a moment. But I think as Christians, we're kind to look at the Bible and read it very thoughtfully and very carefully, which I'm sure you have done. But I don't see in the Bible a sense that we should just say, well, you know, we look to see what is a deception. And I see a deception when I see somebody says something which you can then actually disprove and you know that it is true. And it is not true. And I think, you know, there are things that we see that happen that way. Where you see something where there is a huge number of people from a huge number of different directions saying this is happening. And with climate change, it isn't just the climate scientists, it's the biodiversity people, it's all kinds of people all around the world saying it. And there was a meeting in Lambeth Palace this week which had people from the global south who are saying the experiences they're experiencing of climate changing. So it's coming from all sorts of different directions. I think then we'll have to say, well, who are the people who are deceiving? Is it those many, many voices coming from totally different directions, totally no connection between them? Or is it, elements of the press that are coming in who are, other places who are coming in and saying things. Quite often when you trace back those who are saying that climate change isn't happening, and there are one or two quite senior scientists, Professor Christie in North America, and one or two others, you will actually find their research, if you do trace it, is funded by guess what. And that is something that you need to consider when you consider where is this happening. Sometimes people say, well, they can't publish their work. And there's been examples of scientists who actually are not climate scientists at all, or are scientists in other areas who come in and you know, you sort of think, well, people do publish their work. Good scientists do publish it. So I think that you have to say, well, where is the truth? But I'll pass on to Martin because he knows a lot more about this than me.
Yeah, we actually wrote a booklet on.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Essentially, if you look at the scientists, the surveys of scientists have indicated that of the climate scientists, around about 97% that are saying we have a very serious problem. As Margot has indicated, the 3%, where they're getting their funding, you need to look at quite carefully. But the truth of the matter is now, you look at what's happening around the world, and you don't actually have to be a climate scientist to see that we've got problems. You just look at the news almost any day of the week, and something is happening somewhere, and it's increasing and it's getting worse. So, you know, we've got the scientific evidence. We've also got the evidence of our own eyes. The winters in this country are getting warmer and warmer. Spring is now about 3 weeks later on average than it was, say, 40 years ago.
Earlier.
Earlier than it was. So, you know, we've got a whole lot of evidence that we can see with our eyes, as well as what the scientists are telling us. And then you do, as Margot has indicated, you have to look at where the opposition to this idea is coming from. And a lot of it is back, if you trace it back, you look at the American politicians. Now, they actually have to tell you who funds them by law. So they all say, particularly the Republicans, right, fossil fuel companies, Exxon, boom, 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 fossil fuel companies. Incidentally, they also say National Rifle Association, right, which is why Obama could never get through his any legislation, because they're all paid by these guys. Then you look at the press, and some of our big press magnates have huge interest in fossil fuels. So why do you think that the press goes in a particular direction? You know, you add up the whole picture, and you have to look and say, who is deceiving who?
But I think it can be confusing for people if you're just looking at the popular press and finding things on websites. But I think the evidence is clear. The deception is not coming from the scientists who say that the climate change is real. But thank you very much for your question. It was, you know, it's very good to raise that.
And I'm going to take that as the last question, because it's time to wrap up. I'm sure that Martin and Margot will be around for a little while, but we've given them a pretty good hammering. So thank you very much indeed for your talk and question.
I was just going to make two comments. First of all, if you've been to the Our Fragile Planet series, we have been talking about nothing but climate change, but as well pollution and all the different stuff. If you're still doubting or not sure, have a look at our recordings on the website. You'll see the slides, you'll hear the audios. But I think it's a very sort of deep set, you know, sort of unease in the Christian church that they can't quite believe that really is something happening and we've really got to do something about it. So for those of you who are convinced that we need to do something urgently about both pollution but also climate change, there's a very active community in Bristol. The city council has just voted to try and become carbon neutral by 2030. Come and find me if you want to get stuck into something. Something which is less contentious, if you like. Climate change isn't contentious. But there is a clean air directive that the city's got, and a few of us have got together to produce a campaign postcard about clean air, having a clean air zone, which I hope no one would disagree with having clean air. So, yes, please get stuck in. We don't need to reinvent the wheel.